One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Oh, welcome back, my friends. The fire is burning bright and the night shadows seem a little darker than usual, don't they? Well, maybe it's just me, or maybe it's something else. Tonight, we're going to take a journey, a long one, across dense jungles, into forgotten villages, and deep into the unknown. Have you ever wondered if we're alone in the universe? If anyone out there is trying to reach us? Tonight's story might not answer those questions, but it will leave you with a whole lot to think about. This one's for those of you brave enough to peer into the cosmos and see what's staring back. Ah, I see some familiar faces around the fire tonight. Mia, still here, I see. Did you recover from last week's tale about haunted relics? No? Well, maybe tonight's story will give you something new to lose sleep over. And Tyler, I know that skeptical look anywhere. You still don't believe in ghosts, do you? Well, this story isn't about ghosts exactly, but trust me, it'll make you question everything you think you know about reality. And Lucy, welcome back. Did you figure out how to keep those nightmares at bay? No? Well, let's hope tonight's story doesn't make them worse. All right, campers, let's settle in. Tonight's tale comes from the legendary Jack London, and it's one of the most mysterious and thought-provoking works. It's called The Red One. There it was. The abrupt liberation of sound. As he timed it with his watch, Bassett likened it to the trump of an archangel. Walls of cities, he meditated, might well fall down before so vast and compelling a summons. For the thousandth time, vainly, he tried to analyze the tone quality of that enormous peal that dominated the land far into the strongholds of the surrounding tribes. The mountain gorge, which was its source, rang to the rising tide of it before it brimmed over and flooded earth and sky and air. With the wantonness of a sick man's fancy, he likened it to the mighty cry of some titan of the elder world, vexed with misery or wrath. Higher and higher it rose, challenging and demanding in such profounds of volume that it seemed intended for ears beyond the narrow confines of the solar system. There was in it, too, the clamor of protest in that there were no ears to hear and comprehend its utterance. Such a sick man's fancy. Still, he strove to analyze the sound. Sonorous as thunder was it, mellow as a golden bell, thin and sweet as a thrumped taut cord of silver. No, it was none of these, nor a blend of these. There were no words nor semblances in his vocabulary and experience with which to describe the tonality of that sound. Time passed, Minutes merged into quarters of hours, and quarters of hours into half hours, and still the sound persisted, ever changing from its initial vocal impulse, yet never receiving fresh impulse, fading, dimming, dying as enormously as it had sprung into being. It became a confusion of troubled mutterings and babblings and colossal whisperings. Slowly it withdrew, sob by sob, into whatever great bosom had birthed it, until it whimpered deadly whispers of wrath and as equally seductive whispers of delight, striving still to be heard, to convey some cosmic secret, some understanding of infinite import and value. It dwindled to a ghost of sound that had lost its menace and promise, and became a thing that pulsed on in the sick man's consciousness for minutes after it had ceased. When he could no longer hear it, Bassett glanced at his watch. An hour had elapsed ere that archangel's trump had subsided into tonal nothingness. Was this, then, his dark tower? Bassett pondered, remembering his Browning and gazing at his skeleton-like and fever-wasted hands. And the fancy made him smile, of child Roland bearing a slughorn to his lips with an arm as feeble as his was. Was it months or years, he asked himself, since he first heard that mysterious call on the beach at Ringmenu? To save himself, he could not tell. The long sickness had been most long. In conscious count of time, he knew of months, many of them, but he had no way of estimating the long intervals of delirium and stupor. And how fared Captain Bateman of the Blackbirder Nary, he wondered. And had Captain Bateman's drunken mate died of delirium tremens yet? From which vain speculations, Bassett turned idly to review all that had occurred since that day on the beach at Ringmenu, when he first heard the sound and plunged into the jungle after it. Sagawa had protested. He could see him yet, his queer little monkeyish face eloquent with fear, his back burdened with specimen cases, in his hands Bassett's butterfly net and naturalist shotgun, as he quavered in Besh Demir English. Me fella too much fright along bush. Bad fella boy, too much stompin' along bush. Bassett smiled sadly at the recollection. The little New Hanover boy had been frightened, but had proved faithful, following him without hesitancy into the bush in the quest after the source of the wonderful sound. No fired hollowed tree trunk, that throbbing war through the jungle depths, had been Bassett's conclusion. Erroneous had been his next conclusion, namely, that the source or cause could not be more distant than an hour's walk, and that he would easily be back by mid-afternoon to be picked up by the Nari's whaleboat. That big fella noise no good, all the same, devil, Sagawa had adjudged. And Sagawa had been right. Had he not had his head hacked off within the day? Bassett shuddered. Without doubt, Sagawa had been eaten as well by the bad fellow boys too much that stopped along the bush. He could see him, as he had last seen him, stripped of the shotgun and all the naturalist gear of his master, lying on the narrow trail where he had been decapitated barely the moment before. Yes, within a minute the thing had happened. Within a minute, looking back, Bassett had seen him trudging patiently along under his burdens. Then Bassett's own trouble had come upon him. He looked at the cruelly healed stumps of the first and second fingers of his left hand, then rubbed them softly into the indentation at the back of his skull. Quick as he had been, the flash of the long-handled tomahawk, he had been quick enough to duck away his head and partially to deflect the stroke with his upflung hand. Two fingers and a hasty scalp wound had been the price he'd paid for his life. With one barrel of his 10-gauge shotgun, he had blown the life out of the bushman who had so nearly got him. With the other barrel, he had peppered the bushman bending over Sagawa, and had the pleasure of knowing that the major portion of the charge had gone into the one who had leapt away with Segwa's head. Everything had occurred in a flash. Only himself, the slain bushman, and what remained of Segwa were in the narrow, wild pig run of the path. From the dark jungle on either side came no rustle of movement or sound of life, and he had suffered distinct and dreadful shock. For the first time in his life, he had killed a human being, and he knew nausea as he contemplated the mess of his handiwork. Then he had begun the chase. He retreated up the pig run before his hunters, who were between him and the beach. How many were there? He could not guess. There might have been one, or 100, or aught. He saw of them. That some of them took to the trees and traveled along through the jungle roof, he was certain. But at the most, he never glimpsed more than an occasional flitting of shadows. No bowstrings twanged that he could hear, but every little while, hence discharged, he knew not. Tiny arrows whispered past him or struck tree boles and fluttered to the ground beside him. They were bone-tipped and feather-shafted, and the feathers, torn from the breasts of hummingbirds, iridesced like jewels. Once, and now, after the long lapse of time, he chuckled gleefully at the recollection. He detected a shadow above him that came to instant rest as he turned his gaze upward. He could make out nothing, but deciding to chance it, he fired at it a heavy charge of number 5 shot. Squalling like an infuriated cat, the shadow crashed down through tree ferns and orchids and thudded upon the earth at his feet, and, still squalling its rage and pain, had sunk its human teeth into the ankle of his stout tramping boot. He, on the other hand, was not idle, and with his free foot had done what reduced the squalling to silence. So inured to savagery has Bassett since become, that he chuckled again with the glee of his recollection. What a night had followed! Small wonder that he had accumulated such a virulence and variety of fevers, he thought, as he recalled that sleepless night of torment, when the throb of his wounds was as nothing compared to the myriad stings of the mosquitoes. There'd been no escaping them, and he had not dared to light a fire. Day had literally pumped his body full of poison, so that, with the coming of day, eyes swollen almost shut, he'd stumbled blindly on, not caring much when his head should have hacked off, and his carcass started on the way of Segwa's to the cooking fire. 24 hours had made a wreck of him, of mind as well as body. He'd scarcely retained his wits at all, so maddened was he by the tremendous inoculation of poison he'd received. Several times he fired his shotgun with effect into the shadows that dogged him, stinging day insects and gnats added to his torment, while his bloody wounds attracted hosts of loathsome flies that clung sluggishly to his flesh and had to be brushed off and crushed off. Once in that day he heard again the wonderful sound, seemingly more distant, but rising imperiously above the nearer war drums in the bush. Right there was where he'd made his mistake. Thinking he'd passed beyond it, and that, therefore, it was between him and the beach of Ringmanu, he'd worked back toward it, when in reality he was penetrating deeper and deeper into the mysterious heart of the unexplored island. That night, crawling in among the twisted roots of a banyan tree, he had slept from exhaustion whilst the mosquitoes had their will of him. Followed days and nights that were vague as nightmares in his memory. One clear vision he remembered was of suddenly finding himself in the midst of a bush village and watching the old men and children fleeing into the jungle. All had fled but one. From, close at hand and above him, a whimpering as of some animal in pain and terror had startled him. And looking up, he had seen her, a girl, or a young woman, rather, suspended by one arm in the cooking sun. Perhaps for days she had so hung. Her swollen, protruding tongue spoke as much. Still alive, she gazed at him with eyes of terror. Past help, he decided, as he noted the swelling of her legs, which advertised that the joints had been crushed and the great bones broken. He resolved to shoot her, and there the vision terminated. He could not remember whether he had or not, any more than he could remember how he chanced to be in that village, or how he succeeded in getting away from it. Many pictures, unrelated, came and went in Bassett's mind as he reviewed that period of his terrible wanderings. He remembered invading another village of a dozen houses and driving all before him with his shotgun, save for one old man, too feeble to flee, who spat at him and whined and snarled as he dug open a ground oven and, from amid the hot stones, dragged forth a roasted pig that steamed its essence deliciously through its green leaf wrappings. It was at this place that a wantonness of savagery had seized upon him. Having feasted, ready to depart with a hindquarter of the pig in his hand, he deliberately fired the grass thatch of a house with his burning glass. But seared, deepest of all, in Bassett's brain, was the dank and noisome jungle. It actually stank with evil, and it was always twilight. Rarely did a shaft of sunlight penetrate its matted roof 100 feet overhead. And beneath that roof was an aerial ooze of vegetation, a monstrous, parasitic dripping of decadent life forms that rooted in death and lived on death. And through all of this he drifted, ever pursued by the flitting shadows of the anthropophagy, themselves ghosts of evil that dared not face him in battle, but that knew that sooner or later they would feed on him. Bassett remembered that at the time, in lucid moments, he had likened himself to a wounded bull pursued by plains coyotes, too cowardly to battle with him for the meat of him, yet certain of the inevitable end of him when they would be fully gorged.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
As the bull's horns and stamping hooves kept off the coyotes, so his shotgun kept off these Solomon Islanders, these twilight shades of bushmen of the Isle of Guadalcanal. Came the day of the grasslands. Abruptly, as if cloven by the sword of God in the hand of God, the jungle terminated. The edge of it, perpendicular and as black as the infamy of it, was 100 feet up and down, and beginning at the edge of it grew the grass, sweet, soft, tender pasture grass that would have delighted the eyes and beasts of any husbandman, and that extended on and on for leagues and leagues of velvet verdure to the backbone of the great island, the towering mountain range flung up by some ancient earth cataclysm, serrated and gullied, but not yet erased by the erosive tropic rains. But the grass! He had crawled into it a dozen yards, buried his face in it, smelled it, and broken down in a fit of involuntary weeping. And while he wept, the wonderful sound had pealed forth, if by peal, he had often thought since, an adequate description could be given above the enunciation of so vast a sound melting sweet. Sweet it was, as no sound ever heard. Vast it was, of so mighty a resonance that it might have proceeded from some brazen-throated monster. And yet it called to him across that leagues-wide savanna, and was like a benediction to his long-suffering, pain-racked spirit. He remembered how he lay there in the grass, wet-cheeked but no longer sobbing, listening to the sound and wondering that he had been able to hear it on the beach of Ring Menu. Some freak of air pressures and air currents, he reflected, had made it possible for the sound to carry so far. Such conditions might unhappen again in 1,000 days or 10,000 days. But the one day it had happened had been the day he landed from the Neri for several hours collecting. Especially had he been in quest of the famed jungle butterfly, a foot across from wingtip to wingtip, as velvet dusky of lack of color as was the gloom of the roof, of such lofty arboreal habits that it resorted only to the jungle roof and could be brought down only by a dose of shot. It was for this purpose that Sagawaw had carried the 10-gauge shotgun. 2 days and nights he had spent crawling across that belt of grassland. He had suffered much, but pursuit had ceased at the jungle edge, and he would have died of thirst had not a heavy thunderstorm revived him on the second day. And then had come Balada. In the first shade where the savanna yielded to the dense mountain jungle, he had collapsed to die. At first she had squealed with delight at sight of his helplessness, and was for beating his brain out with a stout forest branch. Perhaps it was his very utter hopelessness that had appealed to her, and perhaps it was her human curiosity that made her refrain. At any rate, she had refrained, for he opened his eyes again under the impending blow and saw her studying him intently. What especially struck her about him were his blue eyes and white skin. Coolly, she had squatted on her hams, spat on his arm, and with her fingertips rubbed away the dirt of days and nights of muck and jungle that sullied the pristine whiteness of his skin. And everything about her had struck him especially, although there was nothing conventional about her at all. He laughed weakly at the recollection, for she had been an innocent of a garb as Eve before the fig-leaf adventure. Squat and lean at the same time, asymmetrically limbed, string-muscled as if with lengths of cordage, dirt-caked from infancy save for casual showers, she was as unbeautiful a prototype of a woman as he, with a science eyes, had ever gazed upon. Her breasts advertised at the one time her maturity and youth, and, if by nothing else, her sex was advertised by the one article of finery with which she was adorned, namely a pig's tail, thrust through a hole in her left earlobe. So, lately, had the tail been severed that its raw end still oozed blood that dried upon her shoulder like so much candle droppings. And her face, a twisted and wizened complex of apish features, perforated by upturned, sky-open Mongolian nostrils, by a mouth that sagged from a huge upper lip and faded precipitately into a retreating chin, by peering, querulously eyes that blinked as blink the eyes of denizens of monkey cages. Not even the water she brought him in a forest leaf and the ancient and half-putrid chunk of roast pig could redeem in the slightest the grotesqueness and hideousness of her. When he had eaten weakly for a space, he closed his eyes in order not to see her, although again and again she poked them open to peer at the blue of them. Then had come this sound. Nearer, much nearer, he knew it to be, and he knew equally well, despite the weary way he had come, that it was still many hours distant. The effect of it on her had been startling. She cringed under it, with averted face, moaning and chattering with fear. But after it had lived its full life of an hour, he closed his eyes and fell asleep with Balada brushing the flies from him. When he awoke, it was night and she was gone. But he was aware of renewed strength and, by then, too thoroughly inoculated by the mosquito poison to suffer further inflammation, He closed his eyes and slept an unbroken stretch till sunup. A little later, Balada had returned, bringing with her a half-dozen women who, unbeautiful as they were patently not so unbeautiful as she. She evidenced by her conduct that she considered him her find, her property, and took pride she took in showing him off. Would have been ludicrous had his situation not been so desperate. Later, after what had been to him a terrible journey of miles, when he collapsed in front of the Devil house in the shadow of the breadfruit tree, she'd shown very lively ideas on the matter of retaining possession of him. Nagorn, who Bassett was to know afterward as the Devil doctor, priest, or medicine man of the village, had wanted his head. Others of the grinning and chattering monkey men, all as stark of clothes and bestial of appearance as Balada, had wanted his body for the roasting oven. At that time, he had not understood their language, if by language might be dignified by uncouth sounds they made to represent ideas. But Bassett had thoroughly understood the matter of debate, especially when the men pressed and prodded and felt the flesh of him as if he were so much commodity in a butcher's stall. Balada had been losing the debate rapidly when the incident happened. One of the men, curiously examining Bassett's shotgun, managed to cock and pull a trigger. The recoil of the butt into the pit of the man's stomach had not been the most sanguinary result, for the shot of charge, at a distance of a yard, had blown the head off of one of the debaters into nothingness. Even Balada joined the others in flight, and ere they returned, his senses already reeling from the oncoming fever attack, Bassett had regained possession of the gun. Whereupon, although his teeth chattered with the ague, and his swimming eyes could scarcely see, he held on to his fading consciousness until he could intimidate the bushman with the simple magics of compass, watch, burning glass, and matches. At the last, with due emphasis of solemnity and awfulness, he had killed a young pig with his shotgun and promptly fainted. Bassett flexed his arm muscles in quest of what possible strength might reside in such weakness, and he dragged himself slowly and totteringly to his feet. He was shockingly emaciated, yet during the various convalescence of the many months of his long sickness, he'd never regained quite the same degree of strength as his time. What he feared was another relapse such as he had already frequently experienced. Without drugs, without even quinine, he'd managed so far to live through a combination of the most pernicious and most malignant of malarial and blackwater fevers. But could he continue to endure? Such was his everlasting query. For, like the genuine scientist he was, he would not be content to die until he had solved the secret of the sound. Supported by a staff, he staggered the few steps to the Devil house, where Death and Nagurin reigned in gloom. Almost as infamously dark and evil-stinking as the jungle was the Devil house, in Bassett's opinion. Yet therein was usually to be found his favorite crony and gossip, Nagurin, always willing for a yarn or a discussion, while he sat in the ashes of Death, and in a slow smoke shrewdly revolved curing human heads suspended from the rafters. For, through the month's interval of consciousness of his long sickness, Bassett had mastered the psychological simplicities and lingual difficulties of the language of the tribe of Nagurin and Balada and Vinunyan, the latter the addled-headed young chief who was ruled by Nagurin and who, whispered intrigue at it, was the son of Nagurin. "Will the Red One speak today?" Bassett asked, by this time so accustomed to the old man's gruesome occupation as to take even an interest in the progress of the smoke curing. With the eye of an expert, Nagurin examined the particular head he was at work upon. "It will be 10 days before I can say finish," he said. "Never is any man's fixed heads like these." Bassett smiled inwardly at the old fellow's reluctance to talk to him about the Red One. It had always been so. Never, by any chance, Had Nagorin, or any other member of the weird tribe, divulged the slightest hint of any physical characteristic of the Red One. Physical the Red One must be, to emit the wonderful sound, and though it was called the Red One, Bassett could not be sure that red represented the color of it. Red enough were the deeds and powers from it, from what abstract clues he'd gleaned. Not alone, had Nagurn informed him, was the Red One more bestial powerful than the neighbor tribal gods, ever athirst for the red blood of living human sacrifices. But the neighbor gods themselves were sacrificed and tormented before him. He was the god of a dozen allied villages similar to this one, which was the central and commanding village of the Federation. By virtue of the Red One, many alien villages had been devastated and even wiped out. The prisoners sacrificed to the Red One. This was true today, and it extended back into old history, carried down by word of mouth through the generations. When he, Nagorn, had been a young man, the tribes were beyond the grasslands and made a war raid. In the counter raid, Nagorn and his fighting folk had made many prisoners. Of children alone, over 50 living had been bled white before the Red One, and many, many, many more men and women. The Thunderer was another of Nagurn's names for the mysterious deity. Also at times he was called the Loud Shouter, the God-voiced, the Bird-throated, the one with the throat so sweet as the throat of the Honeybird, the Sunslinger, and the Starborn. Why the Starborn? In vain Bassett interrogated Nagurn. According to that old devil-devil doctor, the Red One had always been just where he was at present, forever singing and thundering his will over men. But Nagurn's father, wrapped in decaying grass matting and hanging even then over the heads among the smoky rafters of the devil-devil house, had held otherwise. That departed wise one had believed that the Red One came out of the starry night. Why else, so his argument had run, had the old and forgotten ones passed his name down as the Starborn? Bassett could not but recognize something cogent in such an argument. But Nagurn affirmed the long years of his long life, wherein he gazed upon many starry nights, yet never had he found a star on grassland or in depth in the jungle, and he had looked for them. True, he had beheld shooting stars, this in reply to Bassett's contention, but likewise had he beheld the phosphorescence of fungoid growths and rotten meat and fireflies on dark nights, and the flames of wood fires and of blazing candle nuts. Yet what were flame and blaze and glow when they had flamed and blazed and glowed? Answer? Memories, memories only, of things which had ceased to be, like memories of matings accomplished, of feasts forgotten, of desires that were the ghosts of desires, flaring, flaming, burning, yet unrealized in achievement, appeasement, and satisfaction. Where was the appetite of yesterday? The roasted flesh of the wild pig the hunter's arrow failed to slay. The maid, unwed and dead, ere the young man knew her. A memory was not a star, was Nagurn's contention. How could a memory be a star? Further, after all his long life, he still observed the starry night sky unaltered. Never had he noted the absence of a single star from its accustomed place. Besides, stars were fire, and the Red One was not fire, which last involuntary betrayal told Bassett nothing. "Will the Red One speak tomorrow?" he queried. Nagurn shrugged his shoulders, as who should say. "And the day after? And the day after that?" Bassett persisted. "I would like to have the curing of your head." Nagurn changed the subject. "It is different from any other head. No devil-devil has a head like it. Besides, I would cure it well. It would take months and months. The moons would come and the moons would go, and the smoke would be very slow, and I should myself gather the materials for the curing smoke. The skin would not wrinkle. It would be as smooth as your skin now." He stood up, and from the dim rafters, grimed with the smoking of countless heads, where day was no more than gloom, took down a matting-wrapped parcel and began to open it. "It is a head like yours," he said, "but it is surely cured." Bassett had pricked up its ears at the suggestion that it was a white man's head, for he had long since come to accept that these jungle dwellers in the midmost center of the great island had never had intercourse with white men. Certainly he had found them without the almost universal bêche de mer English of the West South Pacific. Nor had they knowledge of tobacco, nor of gunpowder. Their few precious knives, made from lengths of hoop iron, and their few and more precious tomahawks, from cheap trade hatchets, he had surmised, they'd captured in war from the bushmen of the jungle beyond the grasslands, and that they, in turn, had similarly gained them from the saltwater men who fringed the coral beaches of the shore and had contact with the occasional white man.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
The folk in the out beyond do not know how to cure heads, old Nagurn explained, as he drew forth from the filthy matting and placed in Bassett's hands an indubitable white man's head. Ancient it was beyond question. White it was, as the blonde hair attested. He could have sworn it once belonged to an Englishman, and to an Englishman of long before, by token of the heavy gold circlets still threaded in the withered earlobes. "Now your head," the devil doctor began, on his favorite topic. "I tell you what," Bassett interrupted, struck by a new idea. "When I die, I'll let you have my head to cure. First, you take me to look upon the red one." "I'll have your head anyway when you're dead." Nagurin rejected the proposition. He added with the brutal frankness of the savage, "Besides, you have not long to live. You are almost a dead man now. You will grow less strong. In not many months I shall have you here turning and turning in the smoke. It is pleasant, through the long afternoons, to turn the head of one of you I have known as well as I know you. And I shall talk to you and tell you the many secrets you want to know, which will not matter, for you will be dead." "Nagurn," Bassett threatened in sudden anger, "you know the baby thunder and the iron that is mine." This was in reference to his all-potent and all-awful shotgun. "I can kill you any time, and then you will not get my head." "Just the same will Vinyan, or someone else of my folk, get it," Nagurn complacently assured him. "And just the same will in the end turn Devil House in the smoke. The quicker you slay me with your baby thunder, the quicker will your head turn in the smoke." And Bassett knew he had been beaten in the discussion. What was the red one? Bassett asked himself 1,000 times in the succeeding week, while he seemed to grow stronger. What was the source of the wonderful sound? What was this sun singer, this starborn one, this mysterious deity, as bestial conducted as the black and kinky-headed and monkey-like human beasts who worshipped it, and whose silver-sweet, bull-mouth singing and commanding he had heard at the taboo distance for so long? Nagurn, had he failed to bribe the inevitable curing of his head when he was dead, Vinyan, imbecile and chief that he was too imbecilic too much under the sway of Nagurn to be considered, remained Balada, who, from the time she found him and poked his blue eyes open to recrudescence of her grotesque female hideousness, had continued his adorer. Woman she was, and he had long known that the only way to win from her tracing of her tribe was through the woman's heart of her. Bassett was a fastidious man. He had never recovered from the initial horror caused by Balada's female awfulness. Back in England, even the best the charm of woman to him had never been robust. Yet now, resolutely, as only a man can do who is capable of martyring himself for the cause of science, he proceeded to violate all the fineness and delicacy of his nature by making love to the unthinkably disgusting bushwoman. He shuddered, but with averted face hid his grimaces, and swallowed his gorge as he put his arm around her dirt-crusted shoulders and felt the contact of her rancid, oily, and kinky hair with his neck and chin. But he nearly screamed when she succumbed to that caress so at the very first of the courtship, and mowed and gibbered and squealed like queer, pig-like girly noises of delight. It was too much. And the next he did in the singular courtship was to take her down to the stream and give her a vigorous scrubbing. From then on he devoted himself to her like a true swain, as frequently and for as long at a time as his will could override his repugnance. But marriage, which he ardently suggested, was due observance of tribal custom, he balked at. Fortunately, taboo rule was strong in the tribe. Thus, Nagurn could never touch bone or flesh or hide of crocodile. This had been ordained at his birth. Finian was denied ever the touch of woman. Such pollution, did it chance to occur, could be purged only by the death of the offending female. It had happened once, since Bassett's arrival, when a girl of 9, running in play, stumbled and fell against the sacred chief, and the girl child was seen no more. In whispers, Balada told Bassett that she had been 3 days and nights in dying before the Red One. As for Balada, the breadfruit was taboo to her, for which Bassett was thankful. The taboo might have been water. For himself, he fabricated a special taboo. Only he could marry, he explained, when the Southern Cross rode highest in the sky. Knowing his astronomy, he thus gained a reprieve of nearly 9 months, and he was confident that within that time he would either be dead or escape to the coast with full knowledge of the Red One and of the source of the Red One's wonderful voice. At first he had fancied the Red One to be some colossal statue, like Memnon, rendered vocal under certain temperature conditions of sunlight. But when, after a war raid, a batch of prisoners was brought in, and the sacrifice made at night in the midst of the rain, when the sun could play no part, the Red One had been more vocal than usual, and Bassett discarded that hypothesis. In company with Balada, sometimes with men and parties of women, the freedom of the jungle was his for 3 quadrants of the compass. But the 4th quadrant, which contained the Red One's abiding place, was taboo. He made more thorough love to Balada, also saw to it that she scrubbed herself more frequently. Eternal female was capable of any treason for the sake of love. And though the sight of her was provocative of nausea, and the contact of her provocative of despair, although he could not escape her awfulness in his dream-haunted nightmares of her, he nevertheless was aware of the cosmic verity of sex that animated her and made her own life of less value than the happiness of her lover with whom she hoped to mate. Juliet or Balada? Where was the intrinsic difference? The soft and tender product of ultra-civilization, or her bestial prototype of 100,000 years before her? There was no difference. Bassett was a scientist first, a humanist afterward. In the jungle heart of Guadalcanal, he put the affair to the test, as in the laboratory he would have put to test any chemical reaction. increased his feigned ardor of the bushwoman, at the same time increasing the imperiousness of his will of desire over her to be led to look upon the Red One face to face. It was the old story, he recognized, that the woman must pay, and it occurred when the two of them, one day, were catching the unclassified and unnamed little blackfish, an inch long, half eel and half scaled, rotund with salmon golden roe, that frequented the fresh water, and that were esteemed, raw and whole, fresh or putrid, a perfect delicacy. Prone in the muck of the decaying jungle floor, Balada threw herself, clutching his ankles with her hands, kissing his feet and making slubbery noises that chilled his backbone up and down again. She begged him to kill her rather than exact this ultimate love payment. She told him of the penalty of breaking the taboo of the Red One. A week of torture living, the details of which she yammered from her face in the mire until he realized that he was yet a tyro in knowledge of the fruitfulness the human was capable of wreaking on the human. Yet did Bassett insist on having his man's will satisfied at the woman's risk, that he might solve the mystery of the Red One singing, though she should die long and horribly and screaming. And Balada, being mere woman, yielded. She led him into the forbidden quadrant, an abrupt mountain shouldering in from the north to meet a similar intrusion from the south, tormented the stream in which they had fished into a deep and gloomy gorge. After a mile along the gorge, the way plunged sharply upward until they crossed a saddle of raw limestone, which attracted the geologist's eye. Still climbing, although he paused often from sheer physical weakness, they scaled forest-clad heights until they emerged on a naked mesa or tableland. Bassett recognized the stuff of its composition as black volcanic sand and knew that a pocket magnet could have captured a full load of the sharply angular grains he trod upon. And then, holding Balada by the hand and leading her onward, he came to it. A tremendous pit, obviously artificial, in the heart of the plateau. Old history, the South Sea's sailing direction, scores of remembered data and connotations swift and furious surged through his brain. It was Mendana who had discovered the islands and named them Solomons, believing that he had found the monarch's fabled mines. They had laughed at the old navigator's childlike credulity, and yet here stood himself, Bassett, on the rim of an excavation for all the world like the diamond pits of South Africa. But no diamonds this that he gazed down upon. Rather was it a pearl with the depth of iridescence of a pearl, but of a size all pearls of earth and time welded into one could not have told, and of a color undreamed of in any pearl or of anything else, for that matter, for it was the color of the Red One, and the Red One himself, Bassett, knew it to be on the instant. A perfect sphere, full 200 feet in diameter. The top of it was 100 feet below the level of the rim. He likened the color quality of it to lacquer. Indeed, he took it to be some sort of lacquer applied by man, but a lacquer too marvelously clever to have been manufactured by the bush folk. Brighter than bright cherry red, its richness of color was as if it were red builded upon red. It glowed and iridesced in the sunlight, as if glimming up from underlay under underlay of red. In vain Balada strove to dissuade him from descending. She threw herself in the dirt, but when he continued down the trail that spiraled the pit wall, she followed, cringing and whimpering her terror. That the red sphere had been dug out as a precious thing was patent. Considering the paucity of members of the Federated 12 Villages and their primitive tools and methods, Bassett knew that the toil of a myriad generations could scarcely have made that enormous excavation. He found a pit bottom carpeted with human bones, among which, battered and defaced, lay village gods of wood and stone, some covered with obscene totemic figures and designs, were carved from solid tree trunks 40 or 50 feet in length. He noted the absence of the shark and turtle gods, so common among the shore villages, and was amazed at the constant recurrence of the helmet motive. What did these jungle savages of the dark heart of Wattle Canal know of helmets? Had Mindana's men-at-arms wore helmets and penetrated here centuries before? And if not, then hence had the bush folk caught the motive. Advancing over the litter of gods and bones, Balata whimpering at his heels, Bassett entered the shadow of the Red One and passed on under its gigantic overhang until he touched it with his fingertips. No lacquer that, nor was the surface smooth as it should have been in the case of lacquer. On the contrary, it was corrugated and pitted, and with here and there patches that showed signs of heat and fusing. Also, the substance of it was metal, though unlike any metal or combination of metals he had ever known. As for the color itself, he decided it to be no application. It was the intrinsic color of the metal itself. He moved his fingertips, which up to that had merely rested, along the surface and felt the whole gigantic sphere quicken and live and respond. It was incredible. So light a touch on so vast a mass. Yet did it quiver under the fingertip caress in rhythmic vibrations that became whisperings and rustlings and mutterings of sound, but of sound so different, so elusively thin that it was shimmering sibilant, so mellow that it was maddeningly sweet, piping like an elfin horn, which last was just what Bassett decided would be like a peal from some bell of the gods reaching earthward from across space. He looked at Balata with swift questioning, but the voice of the Red One he had evoked had flung her face downward and moaning among the bones. He returned to contemplation of the prodigy. Hollow it was, and of no metal known on earth, was his conclusion. It was right named by the ones of old time as Starborn. Only from stars could it have come, and no thing of chance was it. It was a creation of artifice and mind, such perfection of form, such hollowness that it certainly possessed, could not be the result of mere fortuitousness. A child of intelligences, remote and unguessable, working corporally in metals, it indubitably was. He stared at it in amaze. His brain was racing wildfire of hypotheses to account for this far journeyer who had adventured the night of space, threaded the stars, and now rose before him and above him, exhumed by patient anthropophagy, pitted and lacquered by its fiery bath in two atmospheres. But was the color a lacquer of heat upon some familial metal, or was it an intrinsic quality of the metal itself? He thrust in the blue point of his pocket knife to test the constitution of the stuff. Instantly, the entire sphere burst into a mighty whispering, sharp with protest, almost twangingly, goldenly, as if a whisper could possibly be considered a twang, rising higher, sinking deeper, the two extremes of the registry of sound threatening to complete the circle and coalesce in the bull-mouthed thundering he had so often heard beyond the taboo distance. Forgetful of safety, of his own life itself, entranced by the wonder of the unthinkable and unguessable thing, he raised his knife to strike heavily from a long stroke, but was prevented by Balata. She upreared on her own knees in an agony of terror, clasping his knees and supplicating him to desist. In the intensity of her desire to impress him, she put her forearm between her teeth and sank them to the bone. He scarcely observed her act, although he yielded automatically to his gentler instincts and withheld the knife attack. To him, human life had dwarfed to microscopic proportions before this colossal portent of higher life from within the distances of the sidereal universe. As had she been a dog, he kicked the ugly little bushwoman to her feet and compelled her to start with him on the encirclement of the base. Partway around he encountered horrors. Even among the others did he recognize the sun-shriveled remnant of the 9 years girl who had accidentally broken Chief Vinyan's personality taboo. and among what was left of those that had passed, he encountered what was left of one who had not yet passed. Truly, the bush folk named themselves unto the name of the Red One, seeing in him their own vision, which they strove to placate, and pleased with such red offerings. Further around, always treading the bones and images of humans and gods that constituted the floor of this ancient carnal house of sacrifice, he came upon the device by which the Red One was made to send his call, singing thunderously along the jungle belts and grasslands to the far reaches of Ring Manu. Simple and primitive was it, as the Red One's consummate artifice. A great kingpost, 100 feet in length, seasoned by centuries of superstitious care, carven into dynasties of gods, each superimposed, each helmeted, each seated in the open mouth of a crocodile, was slung by ropes twisted by climbing vegetable parasites from the apex of a tripod of 3 great forest trunks, themselves carved into grinning and grotesque adumbrations of man's modern concepts of art and God. From the striker kingpost were suspended ropes of climbers to which men could apply their strength and direction. Like a battering ram, this kingpost could be driven and onward against the mighty red iridescent sphere. Here was where Nagurin officiated and functioned religiously for himself and the 12 tribes under him. Bassett laughed aloud, almost with madness, at the thought of this wonderful messenger, winged with intelligence across space, to fall into a bushman stronghold and be worshipped by ape-like man-eating and head-hunting savages. It was as if God's world had fallen into the muck-mire of the abyss underlying the bottom of hell, as if Jehovah's commandments had been presented on carved stone to the monkeys of the monkey cage at the zoo, as if the Sermon on the Mount had been preached in roaring bedlam of lunatics. The slow weeks passed. The nights by election Bassett spent on the ashen floor of the Devil House, beneath the ever-swinging, slow-curing heads. His reason for this was that it was taboo to the lesser sex of women, and therefore a refuge for him from Balada, who grew more persecutingly and perilously loverly as the Southern Cross rode higher in the sky and marked the imminence of her nuptials. His days Bassett spent in a hammock swung under the shade of the great breadfruit tree before the Devil House. There were breaks in his program when, in the commas of his devastating fever attacks, he lay for days and nights in the House of Heads. Ever he struggled to combat the fever, to live, to continue to live, to grow stronger and stronger against the day when he would be strong enough to dare the grasslands and the belted jungle beyond, and win to the beach, and to some labor-recruiting, blackbirding catch or schooner, and on to civilization and the civilization of man, to whom he could give news of the message from other worlds that lay darkly worshipped by beast-men in the black heart of Guadalcanal's midmost center. On the other nights, lying late under the breadfruit tree, Bassett spent long hours watching the slow setting of the western stars beyond the black wall of jungle where it had been thrust back by the clearing of the village. Possessed of more than a cursory knowledge of astronomy, he took a sick man's pleasure in speculating as to the dwellers of the unseen worlds of those incredibly remote suns, to haunt whose houses of light life came forth, a shy visitant from the rayless crypts of matter. He could no more apprehend limits to time than bounds to space. No subversive radium speculations had shaken his steady scientific faith in the conservation of energy and the indestructibility of matter. Always and forever must there have been stars, and surely, in that cosmic ferment, all must be comparatively alike, comparatively of the same substance or substances, save for the freaks of the ferment. All must obey or compose the same laws that ran without infraction through the entire experience of man. Therefore, he argued and agreed, most worlds in life be appanages to all the suns, as they were appanages to the particular of his own solar system. Even as he lay here under the breadfruit tree, an intelligence that stared across the starry gulfs, so must all the universe be exposed to the ceaseless scrutiny of innumerable eyes like his, though grantedly different, with behind them, by the same token, intelligences that questioned and sought the meaning and the construction of the whole. So reasoning, he felt a soul go forth in kinship with that august company, that multitude whose gaze was forever upon the heiress of infinity. Who were they? What were they? Those far distant and superior ones who had bridged the sky with their gigantic red iridescent heaven-singing message. Surely, and long since, had they, too, trod the path on which man had so recently, by the calendar of the cosmos, set his feet, and to be able to send a message across the pit of space, surely they had reached those heights to which man, in tears and travail and bloody sweat, in darkness and confusion of many councils, was so slowly struggling. And what were they on their heights? Had they won brotherhood? Or had they learned that the law of love imposed the penalty of weakness and decay? Was strife life? Was the rule of all the universe the pitiless rule of natural selection? And almost immediately and poignantly, were their far conclusions, their long-won wisdoms, shut even then in the huge metallic heart of the Red One, waiting for the first Earthman to read? Of one thing he was certain, no drop of red dew shaken from the lion mane of some sun in torment was the sounding sphere. It was of design, not chance, and it contained the speech and wisdom of the stars. What engines and elements and mastered forces, what lore and mysteries and destiny controls might there be? Undoubtedly, since so much could be enclosed in so little a thing as the foundation stone of a public building, this enormous sphere should contain vast histories, profounds of research achieved beyond man's wildest guesses, laws and formulae that, easily mastered, would make man's life on earth, individual and collective, spring up from its present mire to inconceivable heights of purity and power. It was time's greatest gift to blindfold, insatiable, and sky-aspiring man, and to him, Bassett, had been vouchsafed the lordly fortune to be the first to receive this message from man's interstellar kin. No white man, much less no outland man of the other bush tribes, had gazed upon the Red One and lived. Such the law expounded by Nagurn and Bassett. There was such a thing as blood brotherhood. Bassett, in return, had often argued in the past. But Nagurn had stated solemnly, no, even a blood brotherhood was outside the favor of the Red One. Only a man born within the tribe could look upon the Red One and live. But now his guilty secret, known only to Balada, whose fear of immolation before the Red One fast sealed her lips, the situation was different. What he had to do was to recover from the abominable fears that weakened him and gain to civilization. Then he would lead an expedition back, and although the entire population of Guadalcanal he destroyed, extract from the heart of the Red One the message of the world from other worlds. But Bassett's relapses grew more frequent, his brief convalescences less and less vigorous, his periods of coma longer, until he came to know, beyond the last promptings of the optimism inherent in so tremendous a constitution as his own, that he would never live to cross the grasslands, perforate the perilous coast jungle, and reach the sea.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue, you pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
He faded as the Southern Cross rose higher in the sky, until even Balada knew that he would be dead ere the nuptial date, determined by his taboo. Agurn made pilgrimage personally and gathered the smoke materials for the curing of Bassett's head, and to him made proud pronouncement and exhibition of the artistic perfectness of his intention when Bassett should be dead. As for himself, Bassett was not shocked. Too long and too deeply had life ebbed down in him to bite him with fear of its impending extinction. He continued to persist, alternating periods of unconsciousness with periods of semi-consciousness, dreamy and unreal, in which he idly wondered whether he had ever truly beheld the Red One, or whether it was a nightmare fancy of delirium. Came the day when all mists and cobwebs dissolved, when he found his brain clear as a bell, and took just appraisement of his body's weakness. Neither hand nor foot could he lift. So little control of his body did he have that he was scarcely aware of possessing one. Lightly, indeed, his flesh sat upon his soul, and his soul, in its briefness of clarity, knew by its very clarity that the black of cessation was near. He knew the end was close, knew that in all truth he had with his eyes beheld the Red One, the messenger between the worlds, knew that he would never live to carry that message to the world, that message, for aught to the contrary, which might already have waited man's hearing in the heart of Guadalcanal for 10,000 years. And Bassett stirred with resolve, calling Agurn to him, out under the shade of the breadfruit tree, and with the old devil doctor discussing the terms and arrangements of his last life effort, his final adventure in the quick of the flesh. "I know the law, O Nagurn," he concluded the matter. "Whoso is not of the folk may not look upon the Red One and live. I shall not live anyway. Your young men shall carry me before the face of the Red One, and I shall look upon him and hear his voice, and thereupon die under your hand, O Nagurn. Thus will the three things be satisfied. The law, my desire, and your quicker possession of my head, for which all your preparations wait." To which Nagurn consented, adding, "It is better so. A sick man who cannot get well is foolish to live on for so little a while. Also, it is better for the living that he should go. You have been much in the way of late, but not what it was good for me to talk to such a wise one. But for moons of days we've had little talk. Instead, you have taken up room in the House of Heads, making noises like a dying pig, or talking much, and loudly in your own language, which I do not understand. This has been a confusion to me, for I like to think on the great things of the light and dark as I turn the heads up in smoke. Your much noise has been such a disturbance to the long learning and hatching of the final wisdom that will be mine before I die. As for you, upon whom the dark has already brooded, it is well that you die now. And I promise you, in the long days to come, when I turn your head in the smoke, no man of the tribe shall come in to disturb us. And I will tell you many secrets, for I am an old man and very wise, and I shall be adding wisdom to wisdom as I turn your head in the smoke." So a litter was made, and, borne on the shoulders of half a dozen men, Bassett departed on the last little adventure that was to cap the total adventure, for him, of living. with a body of which he was scarcely aware, for even the pain had been exhausted out of it, and with a bright, clear brain that accommodated him to a quiet ecstasy of sheer lucidness of thought, he lay back on the lurching litter and watched the fading of the passing world, beholding for the last time the breadfruit tree before the devil house, the dim day beneath the matted jungle roof, the gloomy gorge between the shouldering mountains, and the saddle of raw limestone and the mesa of black volcanic sand. Down the spiral path of the pit they bore him, encircling the sheening, glowing red one that seemed ever imminent to iridesce from color and light into sweet singing and thunder. And over bones and logs of immolated men and gods they bore him, past the horrors of other immolated ones that yet lived, to the three King Post tripod and the huge King Post striker. Here Bassett, helped by Nagurn and Balata, weakly sat up, swaying weakly from the hips, and with clear, unfaltering, all-seeing eyes gazed upon the Red One. "Once, O Nagurn," he said, not taking his eyes from the sheening, vibrating surface whereon and wherein all the shades of cherry-red played unceasingly, ever a quiver to change into sound, to become silken rustlings, silvery whisperings, golden thrummings of chords, velvet pipings of elfland, mellow distances of thunderings. "I wait," Nagurn prompted after a long pause, the long-handled tomahawk unassumingly ready in his hand. "Once, O Nagurn," Bassett repeated. "Let the Red One speak so that I may see it speak as well as hear it. Then strike thus when I raise my hand, for when I raise my hand, I shall drop my head forward and make place for the stroke at the base of my neck. But, O Nagurn, I, who am I to pass out of the light of day forever, would like to pass with the wonder voice of the Red One singing greatly in my ears. And I promise you that never will a head be so well cured as yours," Nagurn assured him, at the same time signaling the tribesmen to man the propelling rope suspended from the King Post striker. "Your head shall be my greatest piece of work in the curing of heads." Bassett smiled quietly to the old one's conceit as the great carved log drawn back through 20 feet of space was released. The next moment he was lost in ecstasy at the abrupt and thunderous liberation of sound. But such thunder! Mellow it was with preciousness of all sounding metals. Archangels spoke in it. It was magnificently beautiful before all other sounds. It was invested with the intelligence of supermen of planets of other suns. It was the voice of God, seducing and commanding to be heard. And the everlasting miracle of that interstellar metal. Bassett, with his own eyes, saw color and colors transform into sound till the whole visible surface of the vast sphere was a crawl and titillant and vaporous with what he could not tell was color or was sound. In that moment, the interstices of matter were his, and the interfusings and intermating transfusings of matter and force. Time passed. At the last, Bassett was brought back from his ecstasy by an impatient movement of Nagurn. He had quite forgotten the old devil one. A quick flash of fancy brought a husky chuckle into Bassett's throat. His shotgun lay beside him in the litter. All he had to do, muscle to head, was press the trigger and blow his head into nothingness. But why cheat him, was Bassett's next thought. Head-hunting, cannibal beast of a human that was as much ape as human, nevertheless old Nagurn had, according to his lights, played squarer than square. Nagurn was in himself a forerunner of ethics and contract, of consideration and gentleness in man. No, Bassett decided, it would be a ghastly pity and an act of dishonor to cheat the old fellow at the last. His head was Nagurn's, and Nagurn's head to cure it would be. And Bassett, raising his hand in signal, bending forward his head, as agreed, so as to expose cleanly the articulation to his taut spinal cord, forgot Balata, who was merely a woman, a woman merely and only and undesired. He knew without seeing when the razor-edged hatchet rose in the air behind him, and for that instant, ere the end, there fell upon Bassett the shadows of the unknown, a sense of impending marvel of the rending of walls before the unimaginable. Almost, when he knew the blow had started, and just ere the edge of the steel bit the flesh and nerves, it seemed that he gazed upon the serene face of the Medusa, Truth. And, simultaneous with the bite of the steel on the onrush of the dark, in a flashing instant of fancy, he saw the vision of his head turning slowly, always turning, in the devil house beside the breadfruit tree. And that, my friends, was The Red One, written by Jack London, a tale of mystery, sacrifice, and the haunting possibility that we're not alone in this vast universe. Well, yes, Mia, it's unsettling, isn't it? To think that something so extraordinary could end up in the hands of those who can't even comprehend it. Makes you wonder how much of our own world is lost in the same way. Tyler, you're still skeptical, aren't you? You don't think a thing like the Red One could exist? Well, maybe it doesn't. Or maybe it's out there, waiting for the right person to find it. And Lucy, you're awfully quiet tonight. That ending got to you, didn't it? The thought of giving up everything, your life, your very self, just to glimpse the truth? It's a heavy idea, no doubt about it. You see, that's the thing about stories like this. They don't give you easy answers. Instead, they leave you with questions. Big ones. Ones that'll keep you up at night, staring at the stars, wondering what's really out there. Well, campers, that's it for tonight. I hope you enjoyed our journey into the unknown. And be sure to come back next week, if you dare. And remember, the fire's always burning here at Camp Duskwood, waiting for more stories to fuel it. Sleep tight, and keep an eye on the stars. You never know who, or what, might be watching.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.